This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Made You Up by Francesca Zappia, narrated by Amanda Ronconi. Epigraph. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I lift my lids and all is born again. I think I made you up inside my head. You really are not helpful at all. It is decidedly so. I'm glad we're on the same page. Prologue. The Freeing of the Lobsters. If I was good at the grocery store, I got a yoo-hoo. If I was really good, I got to see the lobsters. Today, I was really good. My mother left me at the lobster tank in the middle of the main aisle while she went to get Dad's pork chops from the deli counter. Lobsters fascinated me. Everything from their name, to their claws, to their magnificent red had me hooked. My hair was that kind of red, the kind of red that looks okay on everything but people, because a person's hair is not supposed to be red. Orange? Yes. Auburn? Sure. But not lobster red. I took my pigtails, pressed them against the glass, and stared the nearest lobster straight in the eye. Dad said my hair was lobster red. My mother said it was communist red. I didn't know what a communist was, but it didn't sound good. Even pressing my hair flat against the glass, I couldn't tell if my dad was right. Part of me didn't want either of them to be right. "Let me out," said the lobster. He always said that. I rubbed my hair against the glass like the tank was a genie's lamp and the action would stir up some magic. Maybe, somehow, I could get those lobsters out. They looked so sad, all huddled on top of each other, antennae twitching, claws rubber-banded together.
"Are you buying one?"
I saw Blue Eyes' reflection in the glass of the lobster tank before he spoke. Big blue eyes. Blueberry blue. No, that was too dark. Ocean blue. Too green. Blue like all the blue crayons I had melted into one. The straw I'd jammed down the neck of my yoo-hoo bottle dangled from my lips.
"Are you buying one?"
he said again. I shook my head. He pushed his glasses up his nose, back into place on his golden freckled cheeks. The dirty collar of his shirt slipped down to reveal a freckled shoulder. The stench of fish and pond scum clung to him.
"Did you know fossils of the clawed lobster date back to the Cretaceous?"
he asked. I shook my head. I would have to ask Dad what a Cretaceous was, and took a long, slurping drink of yoo-hoo. He was staring at me, and not the lobster.
"Animalia arthropoda malacostrata decapita nephropidae," he said.
He tripped a little on the last word, but it didn't matter since I hadn't understood anything that had come out of his mouth.
"I like scientific classification," he said.
"I don't know what that means," I said. He pushed his glasses up again.
"Plantae sapindalis rutaceae citrus."
"I don't know what that means either."
"You smell like lemons."
I felt a flurry of delirious joy because he'd said, "You smell like lemons," instead of "Your hair is red." I knew my hair was red. Everyone could see my hair was red. I did not, however, know that I smelled like fruit. "You smell like fish," I told him. He wilted, his freckled cheeks burning.
"I know."
I looked around for my mother. She was still standing in line at the deli counter and didn't seem to have any plans to collect me soon. I grabbed his hand. He jumped and stared at the connection like something both magical and dangerous had happened. "Do you want to be friends?" I asked. He looked up and reset his glasses once again.
"Okay."
"Yoo-hoo?" I offered the drink.
"What's a yoo-hoo?"
I pushed the drink a little closer to his face in case he hadn't seen it. He took the bottle and inspected the straw.
"Mom said I shouldn't drink after someone else. It's unsanitary."
"But it's chocolate," I replied. He looked uncertainly at the yoo-hoo bottle before taking a wimpy sort of sip
and shoving the bottle back my way. He didn't move for a second, didn't speak, but eventually he leaned over for another drink. As it turned out, Blue Eyes knew a lot more than scientific classifications of plants and animals. He knew everything. He knew the prices of everything in the store. He knew how much it would cost to buy all the lobsters in the lobster tank. $101.68, sales tax not included. He knew the names of presidents and what order they served in. He knew the Roman emperors, which impressed me even more. He knew that the circumference of the earth was 40,000 kilometers, and that only the male cardinal was bright red. But he really knew words. Blue Eyes had a word for everything. Words like dactylion and brontide and petrichor. Words whose meanings slipped from my grasp like water. I didn't understand most of what he said, but I didn't mind. He was the first friend I'd ever had. The first real friend. Also, I really liked holding his hand. "Why do you smell like fish?" I asked him. We walked slowly as we talked, making long circles in the main aisle. "I was in a pond," he said.
"Why?"
"I got thrown in."
"Why?"
He shrugged and reached down to scratch at his legs, which were covered in band-aids.
"Why are you hurt?" I asked.
"Animalia annelida hirudinea."
The words left his mouth like a curse. His cheeks flared red as he scratched more fervently. His eyes had gone all watery. We stopped at the tank. One of the store employees came out from behind the seafood counter and, ignoring us, opened a hatch on top of the lobster tank. With one gloved hand, he reached in and pulled out Mr. Lobster. He closed the hatch and carried the lobster off. And I got an idea. "Come here." I pulled Blue Eyes to the back of the tank. He wiped his eyes. I stared at him until he stared back. "Will you help me get the lobsters out?" He sniffed. Then he nodded. I set my Yoo-hoo bottle on the floor and held my arms up. "Can you lift me?" He wrapped his arms around my waist and lifted me. My head shot above the top of the lobster tank, my shoulders level with the hatch. I was a chubby kid, and Blue Eyes probably should have snapped in half, but he only wobbled a bit, grunting. "Just hold still," I told him. The hatch had a handle near the edge. I grabbed it and pulled it open, shivering at the chilly blast of air that whooshed out.
"What are you doing?"
Blue Eyes asked, his voice muffled by his strain and my shirt.
"Be quiet," I said, looking around.
No one had noticed us yet. The lobsters were piled up just below the hatch. I plunged my hand in. Shock raced up my spine from the cold. My fingers closed around the nearest lobster. I expected it to thrash its claws and curl and uncurl its tail, but it didn't. I felt like I was holding a heavy shell. I pulled it out of the water.
"Thank you,"
the lobster said.
"You're welcome," I replied.
I dropped it on the ground. Blue Eyes stumbled, but didn't lose his grip on me. The lobster sat there for a moment, then started crawling along the tile. I reached in for another, and another, and another. And pretty soon, the entire tank of lobsters was crawling across the tile floor of the Meyer supermarket. I didn't know where they were going, but they seemed to have a pretty good idea. Blue Eyes dropped me with a huff, and we both landed in a puddle of cold water. He stared at me, his glasses clinging to the tip of his nose.
"Do you do this all the time?"
he asked. "No," I said. "Just today." He smiled. Then the yelling started. Hands grabbed my arms and jerked me to my feet. My mother was shouting at me, pulling me away from the tank. I looked past her. The lobsters were already gone. Freezing water dripped from my arm. Blue Eyes still stood in the puddle. He picked up my abandoned Yoo-hoo bottle and waved goodbye. I tried to get my mother to stop, to go back so I could ask him his name. She just walked faster.
Part 1. The Tank. Chapter 1. Sometimes I think people take reality for granted. I mean, like how you can tell the difference between a dream and real life. When you're in the dream, you may not know it, but as soon as you wake up, you know that your dream was a dream and whatever happened in it, good or bad, wasn't real. Unless we're in the Matrix, this world is real and what you do in it is real, and that's pretty much all you ever need to know. People take that for granted. For 2 years after that fateful day in the supermarket, I thought I'd really set the lobsters free. I thought they'd crawled away and found the sea and lived happily ever after. When I turned 10, my mother found out that I thought I was some kind of lobster savior. She also found out lobsters looked bright red to me. First, she told me that I hadn't set any lobsters free. I'd gotten my arm into the tank before she'd appeared to pull me away, embarrassed. Then she explained that lobsters only turn bright red after they're boiled. I didn't believe her, because to me they had never been any other color. She never mentioned blue eyes, and I didn't need to ask. My first ever friend was a hallucination, a sparkling entry on my new resume as a crazy person. Then my mother had taken me to see a child therapist, and had gotten my first real introduction to the word insane. Schizophrenia isn't supposed to manifest until a person's late teens at the earliest, but I'd gotten a shot of it at just 7 years old. I was diagnosed at 13. Paranoid got tacked on about a year later, after I verbally attacked a librarian for trying to hand me propaganda pamphlets for an underground communist force operating out of the basement of the public library. She'd always been a very suspect type of librarian. I refuse to believe donning rubber gloves to handle books is a normal and accepted practice, and I don't care what anyone says. My medication helped sometimes. I knew it was working when the world wasn't as colorful and interesting as it normally was, like when I could tell the lobsters in the tank were not bright red, or when I realized that checking my food for tracers was ridiculous, but did it anyway because it calmed the prickle of paranoia on the back of my neck. I also knew it was working when I couldn't remember things clearly, felt like I hadn't slept in days, and tried to put my shoes on backward. Half the time the doctors weren't even sure what the medicine would do. "Well, it should lessen the paranoia, delusions, and hallucinations, but we'll have to wait and see. Oh, and you'll probably feel tired sometimes. Drink lots of fluids, too. You can get dehydrated easily. Also, it could cause a lot of fluctuation in your weight. Really, it's up in the air." The doctors were oodles of help, but I developed my own system for figuring out what was real and what wasn't. I took pictures. Over time, the real remained in the photo, while the hallucinations faded away. I discovered what sorts of things my mind liked to make up, like billboards whose occupants wore gas masks and reminded passers-by that poison gas from Hitler's Nazi Germany was still a very real threat. I didn't have the luxury of taking reality for granted. And I wouldn't say I hated people who did, because that's just about everyone. I didn't hate them. They didn't live in my world. But that never stopped me from wishing I lived in theirs. Chapter 2. The night before my first day of senior year at East Shoal High School, I sat behind the counter at Finnegan's Diner, my eyes scanning the dark windows for signs of suspicious movement. Normally, the paranoia wasn't so bad. I blamed it on the first day thing. Getting chased out of the last school was one thing. Starting at a new one was something completely different. I'd spent all summer at Finnegan's trying not to think about it.
"You know, if Finnegan was here, he'd call you crazy and tell you to get back to work."
I spun around. Tucker leaned against the door to the kitchen, hands jammed in the pockets of his apron, grinning at me. I would have snapped at him if he weren't my only informant about East Shoal, and my only friend. Gangly, bespectacled,
hair black as an oil slick and always perfectly combed forward. Tucker was a busboy, waiter, and cashier here at Finnegan's, not to mention the smartest person I'd ever met. He didn't know about me, so his saying that Finnegan would call me crazy was pure coincidence. Finnegan knew, of course. His sister was my latest therapist, the one who'd gotten me this job. But none of the other employees, like Gus, our mute, chain-smoking cook, had any idea, and I planned on keeping it that way. "Har, har," I replied, trying to act cool. "Beat down the crazy," said the little voice in the back of my head. "Don't let it out, you idiot." The only reason I'd taken the job here was because I needed to appear normal, and maybe a little bit because my mother forced me to take it.
"Any other questions?"
Tucker asked, walking over to lean against the counter next to me.
"Or is the crusade over?"
"You mean the Inquisition?" "And yes, it is." I kept my gaze from wandering back to the windows. "I've been in high school for 3 years already. East Shoal can't be that much different than Hill Park." Tucker snorted.
"East Shoal is different than everywhere. But I guess you'll find out tomorrow."
Tucker was the only person who seemed to think East Shoal wasn't the perfect place to be. My mother thought a new school was a great idea. My therapist insisted I'd do better there. Dad said it'd be okay, but he sounded like my mother had threatened him, and if he had been here and not somewhere in Africa, he would have told me what he really thought.
"Anyway," Tucker said, "weeknights aren't nearly as bad as weekends."
I could tell. It was 10:30 and the place was dead. And by dead, I mean it was like the entire possum population of suburban Indiana. Tucker was supposed to be training me to work nights. I'd only worked the day shift during summer, a plan concocted by my therapist that my mother had quickly blessed. But now that school was starting, we'd agreed I could work at night. I grabbed Finnegan's magic eight ball from behind the cash register. My thumb went for the red scuff mark on the back of the ball, trying to rub it out like I always did whenever I got bored. Tucker was now preoccupied with lining up a pepper shaker cavalry across from a hostile regiment of salt shaker footmen.
"We'll still get a few stragglers," he said. "Creepy late-nighters. We got this really drunk guy one time. You remember him, Gus?"
A thin line of cigarette smoke trailed through the short order window and up to the ceiling. In response to Tucker's question, several large puffs clouded the air. I was pretty sure Gus's cigarette wasn't real. If it was, we were breaking about 100 health codes. Tucker's expression went dark. His eyebrows drew together, his voice flattening out.
"Oh, and there's Miles."
"Miles who?"
"He should be here soon."
Tucker squinted at his condiment skirmish.
"He comes on his way home from work. He's all yours."
I narrowed my eyes. "And why exactly is he all mine?"
"You'll see."
He glanced up when a pair of headlights illuminated the parking lot.
"He's here. Rule one, don't make eye contact."
"What, is he a gorilla? Is this Jurassic Park? Am I going to get attacked?" Tucker shot me a serious look.
"It's a definite possibility."
A kid our age walked through the door. He was wearing a white t-shirt and black jeans. A Meyer polo dangled from one hand. If this was Miles, he didn't give me much of a chance to make eye contact. He went straight to the corner table in my section and sat with his back to the wall. From experience, I knew that seat was the best vantage point in the room. But not everyone was as paranoid as I was. Tucker leaned through the short order window.
"Hey, Gus, you have Miles as usual?"
Gus's cigarette smoke curled in the air as he handed over a cheeseburger and fries. Tucker took the plate, filled a glass with water, and plunked everything on the counter beside me. I jumped when I realized Miles was staring at us over the rims of his glasses. A wad of cash had already been placed on the edge of the table. "Is there something wrong with him?" I whispered. "You know, mentally?"
He's definitely not like the rest of us.
Tucker huffed and went back to building his armies. He's not a communist. He's not wired. Don't check under the table, idiot. He's just a kid who wants some food.
Miles lowered his eyes as I walked up.
Hi,
I said, cringing as the word left my mouth.
Too perky.
I coughed, scanned the windows on either side of the table.
I'm Alex.
I lowered my voice.
I'll be your waitress.
I set the food and water down.
Can I get you anything else?
No, thank you.
He finally looked up.
Several synapses imploded inside my brain.
His eyes. Those eyes.
His glare peeled away the layers of my skin and pinned me to the spot. Blood rushed to my face, my neck, my ears. He had the bluest eyes I'd ever seen. And they were completely impossible.
My palms itched for my camera. I needed to take a picture of him. I needed to document this,
because the freeing of the lobsters hadn't been real, and neither was Blue Eyes. My mother had never mentioned him, not to the therapists, or to Dad, or to anyone. He couldn't be real. I screamed curses at Finnegan in my head. He'd forbidden me from bringing my camera to work after I'd photographed an irate man with an eye patch and a peg leg.
Miles nudged the wad of cash toward me with an index finger.
"Keep the change," he muttered.
I grabbed it and raced back to the counter.
"Hi,"
Tucker mimicked in a high falsetto. "Shut up, I didn't sound like that."
"I can't believe you didn't bite your head off."
I shoved the wad of cash into the register and brushed my hair back with shaking hands.
"Yeah," I said. "Me either."
While Tucker stepped out back for his break, I commandeered his condiment armies. Gus's cigarette smoke wafted toward the ceiling, pulled into the vent. The oscillating fan on the wall made the papers on the employee bulletin board flutter. Halfway through my recreation of the Battle of the Bulge, I shook Finnegan's magic eight ball to find out if the German salt shaker would be successful in his offensive.
"Ask again later."
Useless thing. If the Allies had taken that advice, the Axis would have won the war. I kept myself from looking at Miles for as long as I could. But eventually my eyes wandered back to him, and I couldn't look away. He ate with stiff movements, like he was barely keeping himself from stuffing everything into his mouth. And every few seconds his glasses slid down his nose, and he pushed them back up. He didn't move when I refilled his water. I stared at the top of his sandy-haired head as I poured, mentally urging him to look up. I was so busy focusing that I didn't notice the cup was full until the water ran over the top. I dropped it in shock. The water splashed all over him, across his arm, down his shirt, into his lap. He stood up so fast his head smashed into the overhead light and the entire table tipped.
Oh, crap, I'm sorry.
I ran back to the counter where Tucker stood, a hand clamped over his mouth, his face turning red, and grabbed a towel. Miles used his Meyer polo to absorb some of the water, but he was soaked.
I am so sorry.
I reached out to dry his arm, very aware that my hands were still shaking. He recoiled before I could touch him. Glaring at me, the towel, back at me. Then he grabbed his polo, shoved his glasses up his nose, and escaped.
"It's fine," he muttered as he passed me.
He was out the door before I could say another word. I finished cleaning up the table, then trudged back to the counter. Tucker, composed, took the dishes from me.
"Bravo! Brilliant job."
"Tucker?"
"Yes?"
"Shut up." He laughed and disappeared into the kitchen.
Was that Blue Eyes?
I grabbed the magic eight ball and rubbed the scuff mark as I looked down into its round window.
Better not tell you now. Evasive little bitch.
Chapter 3. The first thing I noticed about East Shoal High School was that it didn't have a bike rack. You know a school is run by stuck-up sons of bitches when it doesn't even have a bike rack. I shoved Irwin behind the blocky green shrubs lining the school's front walk and stepped back to make sure the tires and handlebars were hidden. I didn't expect anyone to steal, touch, or notice him since his rusty diarrhea color made people subconsciously avert their eyes, but I felt better knowing he was out of harm's way. I checked my bag. Books, folders, notebooks, pens, and pencils. My cheap digital camera, one of the first things I'd bought when I'd gotten the job at Finnegan's, dangled from its strap around my wrist. I'd already taken a picture of four suspicious-looking squirrels lined up on the red brick wall outside my neighbor's house this morning, but other than that, the memory card was empty. Then I did my perimeter check. Perimeter checks entailed three things: getting a 360-degree view of my surroundings, noting anything that seemed out of place, like the huge scorched spiral design covering the surface of the parking lot, and filing those things away in case they tried to sneak up on me later. Kids funneled from their cars to the school, ignoring the men in black suits and red ties who stood at even intervals along the school's roof. I should have known public school would have some weird security. We just had normal security officers at the Hill Park School, my former private school. I joined the procession of students, keeping an arm's-length distance between myself and the rest of them, because God knows who was bringing weapons to school these days, all the way to the guidance office, where I stood in line for 4 minutes to get my schedule. While I was there, I took a bunch of college brochures out of the stand in the corner and stuffed them in my backpack, ignoring the weird stares I got from the kid in front of me. I didn't take crap when it came to college. I had to get in, no matter how early I had to start or how many applications I had to send. If I was lucky, I could guilt-trip some scholarships out of a school or two, the way my parents had done with Hill Park. It didn't matter how I did it. Either I got in, or I worked at Finnegan's for the rest of my life. I realized everyone around me was wearing a uniform. Black pants, white button-down shirts, green ties. Gotta love the smell of institutional equality in the morning. My locker was near the cafeteria. Only one other person was there, his locker right next to mine. Miles. Memories of Blue Eyes hit me rapid fire, and I had to turn in a full circle to make sure my surroundings were normal. As I inched closer, I peered into his locker. Nothing unusual. I took a deep breath. Be polite, Alex. Be polite. He won't kill you because of some water. He's not a hallucination. Be polite. Hi, I said, stepping up to my locker. Miles turned, saw me, and jumped so badly his locker door banged against the one next to it, and he almost tripped over his backpack on the floor. His glare burned a hole through my head. Sorry, I said. Didn't mean to scare you. When he didn't reply, I focused on my locker combination. I glanced at him as I tossed my books into my locker. His expression hadn't changed. I'm really sorry about the water. I held out my hand against my better judgment. My mother always said to be polite no matter what, even if the other person might have a knife concealed up his sleeve. I'm Alex. He quirked an eyebrow. The expression was so sudden, so perfect, and so obviously right that I almost laughed. Slowly, so it looked like he thought he might burn himself by touching me, Miles reached out to shake my hand. His fingers were long and thin, spidery, but strong. Miles, he replied. Okay, cool. We released our grips at the same time, hands shooting down to our sides. Glad we got that out of the way. I'll see you later, then. Go, go, go. Get away, get away. I walked away as quickly as I could.
Had I just come into contact with Blue Eyes again after 10 years? Oh, God. Okay. It wouldn't be that bad if he was real, would it? Just because my mother never mentioned him didn't mean he wasn't real. But what if he was an asshole? Screw you, Brain. It wasn't until I got to the stairs that I realized I was being followed. The hairs on the back of my neck prickled, and I grabbed for my camera as I spun around. Miles stood behind me. "Are you doing that on purpose?" I asked.
"Doing what on purpose?"
he replied. "Walking a few steps behind me, close enough so I realize you're there, but not so close you look creepy doing it. And staring." He blinked.
"No."
"It sure feels like you are."
"Maybe you're paranoid."
I stiffened. He rolled his eyes.
"Gunthree?"
he asked. "Mr. Gunthree, AP English, first period." "Yes," I said. Miles pulled a paper from his pocket, unfolded it, and held it out. His schedule. There at the top of the page was his name. Richter, Miles J. His first period was AP English 12. Gunthree. "Fine," I said. "But you don't have to be such a creeper about it." I turned and stalked the rest of the way up the stairs.
"Sucks being new, doesn't it?"
Miles appeared beside me, a weird edge lacing his voice. Shivers worked their way up my arms. "It's not so bad," I said through a clenched jaw.
"Either way," he said, "I think you have an inalienable right to know that dyeing your hair is against the dress code."
"It's not dyed," I snapped.
"Sure."
Miles quirked the eyebrow again.
"Sure it's not."
Chapter 4. When I walked into first period, all I could see of Mr. Gunthree was a pair of thick-soled black boots propped on a class roster. The rest of him hid behind this morning's paper. I did a quick scan of the room, then twisted my way through tight rows of desks and stood in front of him, hoping he'd notice me. He didn't. "Excuse me?" A pair of eyes topped by a heavy line of eyebrow appeared over the paper. He was a stout guy, probably in his 50s, with close-cut, steel-gray hair. I took a step back from the desk, my books in front of my chest like a shield. He lowered the paper.
"Yes?"
"I'm new. I need a uniform."
"The bookstore sells them for about 70.
"Dollars?"
"You can get a spare for free from the janitor, but it won't have the school crest, and don't expect it to fit, or have been washed."
He looked over my head at the clock on the wall.
"If you could please take a seat."
I sat down with my back to the wall. The PA system crackled to life.
"Students of East Shoal, welcome back for another year of school."
I recognized the weedy voice of Mr. McCoy, the principal. My mother and I had talked to him before. She loved him. I was unimpressed.
"I hope you all had a great summer vacation, but now it's time to get back in the swing of things. If you don't have a school uniform, one can be purchased from the bookstore for a minimum fee."
I snorted. No bike rack, $70 uniforms, oblivious principal. This place was just rainbows and unicorns.
"Also," McCoy continued, "this is the yearly reminder that our beloved scoreboard's birthday, the anniversary of its donation to the school, is coming up in just a few short weeks. So everybody get ready, prepare your offerings, and be ready to celebrate this great occasion."
The PA system went quiet. I stared at the ceiling. Did he say offerings? For a scoreboard?
"Roll call."
Mr. Gunthree's voice jerked me back to earth. The talking of the other students in the room ceased. I got the sinking feeling that Gunnery Sergeant Hartman would be teaching us this year. I slipped my camera over the lip of the desk and began taking pictures.
"When I call your name, I will point to a desk. That is your desk,"
There will be no switching, trading, or complaining. Is that understood?
Yes, sir, came the united reply.
Good. Clifford Ackerley.
Mr. Gumphrey pointed to the first desk of the first row.
Here, sir.
A burly kid stood up and moved to his new seat.
Good to see you in AP, Ackerley.
Mr. Gumphrey moved down his list.
Tucker Beaumont.
Tucker stood from somewhere on the side and went to sit behind Clifford. He saw me in the back and smiled. To my dismay, he looked even more hopelessly nerdy here. His school uniform starched straight, his arms full of textbooks and already scribbled on papers, the sort of nerdy that gets picked on by guys like Clifford Ackerley. But I couldn't help giggling a little. It happened every time I heard Tucker's last name. It always reminded me of Chevalier Dayan. Full name, Charles Genevieve Louis Auguste André Timothy Dayan de Beaumont, a French spy who lived the second half of his life as a woman. Mr. Gunthrie called a few more people before getting to Claude Gunthrie, who gave no indication that his father barking orders at him bothered him in the least. I took pictures of everyone. I could analyze details later. I didn't plan on getting close enough to anyone to do it in person.
Celia Hendricks.
Celia Hendricks had been assaulted by a cosmetics store. No hair was naturally that shade of yellow. And that was me talking. Ha ha ha. And her real skin was locked up inside a makeup shell. She wore a black skirt instead of pants, and it rode dangerously up her thigh. Mr. Gunthrie didn't miss this.
Hendricks, that skirt violates the dress code on several levels.
But it's the first day of school, and I didn't know.
Bullshit.
I stared wide-eyed at Mr. Gunthrie, praying nothing about him was a figment of my imagination. Either he was a badass, or I was dreaming.
Go, change, now!
With a huff, Celia stomped out of the room. Mr. Gunthrie sighed and returned to his list. A few more people shifted places.
Miles Richter!
Miles yawned as he dragged his tall self across the room. He fell into his new seat. There were only two people left. Me and a girl who'd been talking to Clifford before class had started. Maybe, just maybe, her last name would be between Rick and Ridge.
Alexandra Ridgemont?
Damn. Everyone turned to look at me as I sat down behind Miles. If they hadn't noticed me before, they did now. And the hair. Oh, the hair. Stop it, idiot. It's fine. They're not looking at you. Okay, they are looking at you. But they're not coming after you. You're okay. Everything's okay. Alex is fine, I said weakly.
Maria Wolf.
Rhea, the last girl said, almost skipping to her spot behind me. Her strawberry blonde ponytail jumped happily as she went. Mr. Gunthrie tossed the class list back onto his desk and stood at the front of the room, hands clasped behind his back, square jaw high.
Today we will have pair discussions of your summer reading. I will pick the pairs. There will be no switching, trading, or complaining. Is that understood?
Yes, sir.
Good.
As if he remembered all of our names after only seeing them once, Mr. Gunthrie pulled pairs out of thin air. Being stuck in the seat behind Miles was my payment for getting to be partners with Tucker, I guess. I didn't know you'd be in my class, I said, when I raced out of my seat and slid into the chair behind his. He was the one person in this room who didn't give me the creeps. And you weren't lying about this place.
People around these parts don't lie about a thing like that.
Tucker tipped an imaginary 10-gallon hat.
And you didn't tell me you were going to be in AP English. I could have told you. Mr. Gunthrie teaches the only one in the school.
He held up the papers he'd scribbled on.
I already finished the discussion. He does the same first assignment every year.
Hope you don't mind. He paused, frowning over my shoulder.
God, Hendricks is doing that thing again. I don't even see why she likes him.
Celia Hendricks, who'd returned wearing a baggy pair of black sweatpants, was leaning over her chair and doing some weird flips with her hair and whisper-calling Miles, who had his back to her. When he ignored her, she began launching balled-up pieces of notebook paper at his head. "Why do you hate him so much?" I asked Tucker.
"I don't know if hate is the right word," he replied. "Am afraid of him. Wish he'd stop staring, and think he's a lunatic are more accurate."
"Afraid of him?"
"The whole school is."
"Why?"
"Because it's impossible to know what's going on in his head."
Tucker looked back to me.
"Have you ever seen a person completely change? Like, completely, completely? So much that they don't have the same facial expressions they used to?" "That's what happened to him."
I hesitated at Tucker's sudden seriousness. "Sounds creepy."
"It was creepy."
Tucker concentrated on a design someone had etched onto his desktop.
"And then he, you know, had to be the best."
Wait a minute. He's the valedictorian?" I knew Tucker didn't like the valedictorian, but during his rants at work, he'd never said who it was. Just that the kid didn't deserve it.
"It's not even that he's beating me,"
Tucker hissed, casting a quick look back at Miles.
"It's that he doesn't try. He doesn't even have to read the book. He just knows everything. I mean, he was sort of like that in middle school, but he was never the best. Half the time he didn't do his work because he thought it was pointless."
I looked back at Miles. He and Claude had apparently finished their discussion, and he'd fallen asleep on his desk. Someone had taped a paper sign to his back that said, "Nazi," in black marker. I shivered. I liked researching Nazis as much as the next war historian, but I would never use the term as a nickname. Nazis scared the daylights out of me. Either everyone at this school was an idiot, or Miles Richter really was as bad as Tucker was making him out to be.
"He has this ridiculous club, too," Tucker said. "The East Shoal Recreational Athletic Support Club. It's just the sort of obnoxious name he'd pick."
I swallowed the sudden unease in my throat. I knew the club name, but I hadn't known it was his club. The sign on Miles's back rose and fell with his breathing.
Hey.
Tucker nudged me.
"Don't let him try to pull anything on you, okay?"
"Pull anything? Like what?"
"Like unscrewing your chair from your desk, or tearing a hole in the bottom of your backpack."
"Okay," I said, frowning. "You know, now I'm pretty sure he's either a gorilla, a T-Rex, or a poltergeist. Anything else I should know about him?"
"Yeah," Tucker said. "If he ever starts talking with a German accent, call me."
Chapter 5. My next three classes of the day were like the first. I walked into the classrooms and spun in a circle, checking everything. If I found something strange, like a World War II-era propaganda poster on the wall, I took a picture of it. I was asked 4 times if my hair was dyed. My AP macro teacher let me know it was against the rules. I told him it was natural. He didn't believe me. I showed him the picture of my mother and my little sister Charlie that I always carried with me because their hair was the same. He sort of believed me. I sat in the chair closest to the door and kept a watchful eye on him for the rest of the period. The cafeteria was huge, so there were plenty of open spots. That was a good thing, because no one paid attention to me in the seat against the wall, picking through my food for communist tracers. Mr. McCoy came over the PA to make another announcement about the scoreboard. People stopped talking and eating to snicker about it, but no one seemed surprised. Miles Richter was in all of my AP classes. My 5th period, study hall, was the only class he wasn't in. I still wasn't sure what Tucker had meant when he'd told me not to let Miles pull anything on me. He hadn't done anything Tucker had warned me about, but he certainly hadn't ignored me. Pre-lunch, when I dropped my pencil in AP U.S. History, he kicked it to the far side of the room before I could pick it up. Because he leaned back and looked at me like,
What are you going to do about it? I shoved his backpack off his desk. In AP government that afternoon, he accidentally stepped on my shoelace, and I nearly fell on my face. When the teacher passed our first homework assignments down the rows, I gave Miles one that had accidentally been ripped in half. In AP chemistry, Mrs. Dalton seated us in alphabetical order and handed out lab notebooks, which look like notebooks on the outside but are filled with graph paper and make you want to kill yourself. She dropped mine onto my desk with a loud thwomp. I kept a careful eye on the back of Miles's neck as I wrote my name on the cover. It turned out lopsided and scratchy, but still legible. Good enough. "I figured we'd start off the school year with a little icebreaker lab," Mrs. Dalton said with a certain lazy cheerfulness as she returned to her desk, popped open a Diet Coke, and chugged half of it down in one go. "Nothing hard, of course. I'm going to assign lab partners and you can get to know each other." I suspected bad karma sneaking up on me with a 9-iron. Probably because of the time I flushed Charlie's entire line of black pawns down the toilet and told her Santa didn't exist. Drawing slips of paper from a beaker filled with names, Mrs. Dalton called out pairs, and I watched the desk slowly empty and partners migrate to lab tables stationed around the edge of the room. "Alexandra Ridgemont," Mrs. Dalton said. Karma prepared to swing. "And Miles Richter." Direct hit. "Results? Minor concussion. May have trouble walking, seeing. Should not engage in any strenuous activity or operate heavy machinery." I got to the lab table before Miles even left his seat. A survey paper waited for us. I checked the kids on the other side of the table. They didn't look remotely threatening, but the worst ones were always the least threatening. The cabinets above my head, and the drain in the sink. "Well, let's get this over with," I said when Miles arrived. He didn't answer, just pulled his pen from behind his ear and flipped open his notebook. I braced my feet farther apart when it felt like the ground was skewing to the left. I waited until he was done writing. "Ready?"
"You can go first."
He pushed his glasses up. I wanted to grab them off his face and pulverize them. I grabbed the paper instead. "First question. What's your full name?"
"Wow, this is going to be stupid."
It was the first reasonable thing he'd said all day.
"Miles James Richter."
I wrote it down. "Alexandra Victoria Ridgemont."
"Well, we both have middle names that don't fit."
Out came the magnificent, quirked eyebrow.
"Next."
"Birthday?"
"May 29th, 1993.
"April 15th, same year," I said. "Siblings?"
"None."
No wonder he was such a brat. Only child. He was probably rich, too. "I have a sister, Charlie." "Any pets?"
"A dog."
Miles wrinkled his nose when he said it, which didn't surprise me. I imagined that Miles was sort of like an overgrown house cat. Slept a lot. Always looked bored. Liked to play with his food before he ate it. I watched a ladybug crawl along the edge of the sink. I was pretty sure it wasn't real. Its spots were shaped like stars. I'd left my camera in my backpack. "None. My dad's allergic." Miles grabbed the paper from me and looked it over.
"You'd think they could bother to make the questions a little more interesting. Favorite color? What can that possibly tell you about a person? Your favorite color could be chartreuse, and it wouldn't make a damn bit of difference."
Then, without waiting for me to answer the question, he wrote chartreuse under favorite color. It was the most animated I'd seen him all day. Listening to him rant relaxed me in a weird kind of way. If he was an angry, ranting asshole, he wasn't blue eyes.
"Then yours is mauve," I said, writing it in the blank. "And look, favorite food? What's that going to tell me?"
"Agreed. What do you like to eat? Pickled frog hearts?" I pressed my pen to my bottom lip and mulled it over. "Yeah. You love pickled frog hearts."
We got through a few more questions. I knew I wasn't imagining the odd looks of our comrades across the table. When we got to pet peeves, Miles said,
"When people say catsup instead of ketchup, it's a condiment, not animal vomit."
He paused a moment and said,
"And that one's true."
"I can't stand it when people get history wrong," I said. "Like saying that Columbus was the first explorer to land on North America when he didn't even land on North America, and the first explorer was Leif Erikson." "And that one is also true." We answered a few more, and by the time we got near the end, something strange started happening to his voice. It was rougher somehow, less fluent. His THs slurred together and his Ws started sounding like Vs. The group across the table stared at him like it was the advent of the apocalypse. I moved down to the last question. "Thank God we're almost done. What's one thing you remember from your childhood?"
"Animalia annelida hirudinea."
Miles bit the end of his pen like he wished he hadn't said it. He didn't look at me, but stared at the two silver faucets arching over the sink basin. Those words. The bandages. The pain I hadn't understood. The yoo-hoo. The smell of fish. A chill seeped from my head to my feet, freezing me to the spot. I stared at him. Sandy brown hair that stuck up all over the place. Metal-framed glasses. Golden freckles sprinkled over nose and cheekbones. Blue eyes. "Stop looking at him, idiot. He'll think you like him or something." I didn't like him. He wasn't even that cute. Was he? Maybe another look would help. No, damn it. Oh, hell. I scratched awkwardly at my notebook, ignoring my pounding heart. Was I supposed to write down what he said? Why was he speaking in scientific classifications? Blue Eyes wasn't real. There had been no one to help me free the lobsters. He hadn't just said that. This was my mind screwing with me. Again. I coughed delicately, pulling on a piece of my hair. "Well, you can write down yoo-hoos for mine."
"Yoo-hoos," he said slowly.
"Yoo-hoos. You know, the best drink ever." Now he was the one staring at me. I rolled my eyes. "Y-O-O-H."
"I can spell, thanks."
His voice had snapped back to normal, fluent and clear. As he began writing, I glanced up at the clock. Class was almost over. My hands shook. When the bell rang, I sprang to collect my bag and join the others moving into the hallway. I felt better when I got away from Miles, like the revelation I'd had in the chemistry classroom had been nothing but a dream, and I'd woken up from it. I didn't understand him. He'd come right out of my delusions. But here he was. He straddled the line between my world and everyone else's, and I didn't like it. We arrived at our lockers at the same time. I ignored him, opened my locker, and reached for my textbooks. They fell right out of their covers like guts out of a fish.
"Looks like someone destroyed the binding in your books," said Miles.
"No shit, asshat." "Screw him. Blue Eyes or not, I wasn't putting up with this." I picked up my ruined books, stuffed them into my bag, and slammed my locker shut. "Guess I'll have to fix them." And then I stomped off toward the gym, knowing I wouldn't be able to get away from him now. Chapter 6 Tucker was wrong about the East Shoal Recreational Athletic Support Club. Miles hadn't chosen that name. Principal McCoy had. And he'd told me so when he explained my mandatory community service to me and my mother. I walked to the main gym now with Miles on my heels. His cat stare burned into my shoulder blades. I stopped inside the gym doors and looked around, trying to be inconspicuous about spinning in circles. The gym was older than the one at Hill Park. I'd expected it to be newer, remodeled, like East Shoal's disgustingly expensive football stadium.
The bleacher row adjacent to the main doors housed the table with the scoreboard controls. The basketball goals were raised to the ceiling, giving me a straight view across the gym to the scoreboard hanging on the far wall. East Shoal High School was spelled along its top in green letters. Miles tapped me on the shoulder, just the tip of his index finger. Just a jolt. I jumped.
"Don't keep them waiting," he said, slipping past me.
At the scorer's table stood five kids laughing together. One of them was a girl I recognized from English. She had a pair of pencils spiking out of her messy blonde bun. The two boys standing next to her were so identical I couldn't tell them apart. I'd never seen the other two, but every one of them stood at attention when Miles walked up. I hovered awkwardly behind him.
"This is Alex," he said without any sort of greeting.
"Alex, this is Theophilia,"
he motioned to the girl from English class.
"Just Theo,"
the girl replied, glaring at him.
"And these are her brothers, Evan and Ian."
He motioned to the two identical boys who grinned in unison.
"To reduce confusion, we're triplets."
Theo thrust out a hand, very businesslike.
"And please don't call me Theophilia."
"No worries," I said, staring at her hand. Guilt had made me shake Miles's, but I had no good reason to go near hers. My parents wanted two boys. They named me after Alexander the Great and my sister after Charlemagne. Theo put her hand down, apparently not at all offended by my refusal to shake it, and laughed.
"Yeah, my parents wanted boys, too. Instead, they got two idiots and a girl."
"Hey!"
Theo's brothers cried in unison. She dropped the clipboard and faked a punch toward their crotches. Both boys recoiled. I knew how genetics worked. Even normal identical twins didn't look as identical as Theo's brothers. My fingers tightened around my camera. Miles rolled his eyes and went on.
"And this is Jetta Lorenk and Art Babro."
Jetta shot Miles a dimpled smile, shoveling her mass of curly hair back over her shoulder.
"It is nice to meet you," she said,
holding out a hand like she'd wait as long as it took for me to shake it. I didn't.
"Are you French?"
I asked instead.
"Oui."
Foreign. Foreign spy. French Communist Party acted on Stalin's instructions during part of World War II. French Communist spy.
"Stop it, stop it, stop it."
I turned to Art, a black kid who was a foot and a half taller than me and whose pecs were about to burst out of his shirt and eat someone. I gave him a 2 on the delusion detector. I didn't trust those pecs.
"Hi,"
he rumbled. I waved weakly.
"This is the rest of the club,"
Miles said, gesturing around to all of them.
"Theo, concession stand. Evan and Ian, bleacher duty."
"Aye, aye, boss."
The triplets saluted and left for their posts.
"Jetta, net and ball carts. Art, get the poles."
The other two departed as well. I relaxed once they were all gone, even though I still had Miles to deal with. Miles, who turned to the scoreboard controls and forgot about me.
"So what do I do?" I asked.
He ignored me.
"Miles!"
He turned, sporting the magnificent quirked eyebrow. "What do I do?"
"You're going to go up there,"
he pointed at the empty bleachers,
"and shut up."
Was there some kind of law about drop-kicking assholes in the face? Probably. They always had laws against things that really needed to be done.
"No," I replied. "I think I'll go sit over there."
I pointed to a spot a few feet from where he had, then marched off to sit there. I crossed my arms and glared at him until he and his eyebrow looked away. Then I yanked all the ruined books out of my bag, piled them beside me, and started my homework. When the volleyball team entered the gym, I paused homework to snap pictures. Jetta and Art setting up the volleyball net like pros, Theo manning the concession stand, Evan and Ian scouring the bleachers for trash, the volleyball team looking perky and athletic in their spandex. The only thing missing was Miles, but he was probably circling somewhere, destroying villages and hoarding gold in his mountain lair. I cracked my neck and returned to calculus.